was a pair of conferences in Amsterdam in 1983 and 1986, which one participant noted, if they had happened in the time of the early church, they would have been written up in the book of Acts. According to Walter Smith, the idea of a practical instructional conference for itinerant evangelists was something that had been burning in Graham's heart for years. He had been pleased with Luzanne as a movement to reach leaders, but wanted something to reach the little guys out in the bushes, the uneducated evangelist in Calcutta or the Congo, whose primary need was not a treatise on how to establish dialogue with a Marxist or a Muslim, but basic instruction in such mundane matters as sermon composition, fundraising, and effective use of films and videotapes. He had thought of such a conference as early as 1954, but it was not until 1977 that he finally pushed the wheels into motion. And what he had in mind was such a mammoth undertaking that it did not come to pass for another 6 years. The kind of gathering Graham envisioned was far more difficult to organize than the Berlin and Lausanne congresses. The first challenge lay in identifying and then contacting the little guys out in the bushes. Simply by virtue of being little guys, most of the men whom Graham sought to help were unknown to the people in charge of sending invitations. German evangelical leader Werner Berklin, a YFC veteran who had worked for BGEA on other projects and who served as executive director for both conferences, acknowledged, as they set about to construct an invitation list, that he and his colleagues had no idea how many itinerant evangelists there were in the world or how to get in touch with them. By contacting church and parachurch leaders for names and references and putting out word that such an event was being planned, conference organizers eventually assembled a list of approximately 10,000 itinerant evangelists in 133 countries. After screening them as carefully as possible and allocating quotas to various countries, nearly 3,900, 70% from third world countries, were invited to assemble in Amsterdam for an International Conference for Itinerant Evangelists, ICIE. Amsterdam was selected because of the few locations in the world capable of providing food, lodging, and meeting places for a gathering of this size. The Netherlands had the additional advantages of being a major international airline center, with its own KLM, Royal Dutch Airlines, offering service from many parts of the world, and a tradition of allowing people from most other countries to obtain visas with little difficulty. Berklin estimated that at least 90% of the invitees who descended on the cosmopolitan Dutch city in July 1983, most of them supported in part or whole by BGEA funds, had never previously attended any kind of conference. Many, perhaps most, had never traveled outside their own countries. The inevitable clash of cultures produced both poignant and comic moments. A third world participant who was taken by bus to the convention center for registration, then directed to board another bus for a ride to his hotel, refused to leave the center. Though he could not speak English or any other language represented at the registration desk, he finally managed, with tears filling his eyes, to make clear that after having come so far and gotten so close, he feared he was about to be deported. On the first day of the conference, several participants unfamiliar with the concept of a coffee break abashed Western colleagues by drinking directly from the cream pitchers. And in a similar misreading of cues, a group of Africans told to relax and dress casually during a day off at the midpoint of the conference, startled and wary tourists by lounging barefoot in the lobby of the downtown Marriott Hotel. Other contrasts between the affluent, sophisticated West and the world's poorer nations made the West seem incredibly prodigal. An Indian man who operated a mission school in Kashmir was appalled to see thousands of plastic water cups thrown into the trash after each coffee break and meal. His little school used similar cups, but instead of throwing them away, it managed to make them last as long as 3 years. With the aid of a food service consultant, he took a large supply of the precious once-used vessels back to his village. With a similar eye for utility, several Africans sacked up large quantities of the rectangular food dishes used by KLM caterers to serve airline-type meals to the participants. The dishes, they explained, would make marvelous roof tiles for their homemade dwellings. The 10-day conference held during a scorching heat wave featured dozens of plenary addresses by the redoubtable workhorses in Billy Graham's stable of associates. Stephen Olford, Louis Palau, Bill Bright, Gottfried Ose Mensah, Evie Hill, Akbar Abdul-Haq, Charlie Riggs, Charles Colson, and more than 100 workshops on such practical topics as finding and securing new sources of financial aid, effective street preaching, and the evangelist family life. At the opening session, Graham himself repeated advice distilled from his own decades of preaching. At a special wives program for those who fill the important role of homemaker for itinerant evangelists, Ruth Graham spoke of growing beautiful, not bitter, and adapting to a husband's needs. And Bill Bright's wife, Vinette, contrasted the roles and attitudes of the secular woman, concerned primarily with self-image, personal achievement, and professional success, with those of the spirit-filled woman, who looks to Jesus Christ for her identity. When Graham and his colleagues first began to plan for Amsterdam 83, they expected it might attract as many as 2,000 evangelists. When actual attendance nearly doubled that, with thousands more having to be turned down and additional thousands writing to plead that another conference be held as soon as possible, the bureaucratic machine that had produced the first conference barely stopped to refuel before getting into gear to organize a 1986 sequel that would be even grander in scope and impact. This time around, organizers knew they would not have trouble drawing a crowd. They did not, however, anticipate the flood of applications generated by announcement of a second conference. By soliciting church leaders around the world for the names of active itinerant evangelists who might benefit from such a meeting, ICIE organizers soon had a list of nearly 62,000 potential invitees, from whom less than 10,000 would be chosen. Interestingly, thousands of those, perhaps as many as a third of the total number, had been encouraged to become evangelists by alumni of the 1983 conference. According to Associate Conference Director Bob Williams, who served as the major hands-on organizer for the gathering, the winnowing out process was a heartbreaking endeavor. "We sent applications to 48,000 people," he explained. "We wrote the other 14,000 and told them we had received so many applications from their part of the world that there was no point in raising their hopes falsely. To get the kind of spread we wanted, we had to set quotas and cut off some countries after the number of applications reached a certain point. We might send an application to someone in a country whose quota had been filled if he came highly recommended. But he'd nearly have to be able to walk on water. From those 48,000, we received 28,000 applications, and we could only take 9,000. Applicants were rated according to a point system designed to favor those likely to benefit most from such a conference, rather than those who already had effective ministries. Those between the ages of 25 and 45 received more points than either younger or older candidates. Those affiliated with known, solid evangelical denominations scored higher than those from known, non-evangelical groups. Those with some education, up to completing high school, outpointed those who had attended college as well as those with little or no education. Those engaged in full-time itinerant evangelism ranked above those who spent only part of their time preaching. The selection committee also favored applicants with a commitment to effective follow-up of their preaching over those who thought it sufficient to preach a few sermons and move on to the next town. In addition, applicants could receive bonus points if they had been recommended by a person known and trusted by the committee, and general response points according to how the Holy Spirit leads. Not all of the selection was done around a table in Amsterdam. Whenever possible, usually while following up the results of the 1983 conference or building support for the 1986 meeting, Williams and his associates made site visits, verifying that applicants were indeed legitimate evangelists, engaged in ministries whose aims and ethos were in harmony with those of Billy Graham's. During a 1985 trip to Nairobi, Williams decided to check out a man reported to be an effective open-air preacher. When he came to a city square where he expected to find the man, he was dismayed to hear a preacher ranting and raving in front of a small band of hecklers. It was not the kind of preaching we want to encourage. Then relieved to learn that the man he sought was holding forth on the other side of the square before a crowd of over 1,000 people. He gave an invitation, Williams recalled, and at least 50 people came forward. Afterwards, we asked him how he accounted for his success. He said, in 1983, a friend of mine went to Amsterdam 83 and attended a workshop on how to do open-air campaigns. 3 years ago, I was doing what that guy on the other side of the square is doing, with no success. No one was paying any attention, except to laugh at me. From my friend, I learned a few basic techniques about how to gather a crowd, how to keep their attention, how to preach a message in a few minutes, because a lot of people walk up for 5 minutes and leave, and how to get church members to work with me. Simple, practical things that people had been using for years, but that were new to me. I just applied them, and they worked. On the same trip, Williams decided to visit an alumnus of the 1983 conference who reportedly had won 8,000 people to Christ since returning home from Amsterdam. That sounded, Williams said, as if he might be speaking evangelistically. They stretch it sometimes. So we went down to see about it. We flew in a little missionary aviation fellowship plane, and a missionary met us at a mission hospital about 200 miles from Nairobi. We said, "Tell us about this man. We hear that he has had 8,000 decisions since 1983. Is that true?" The missionary said, "No, it's not true. It's 8,000 each year since 1983. We asked him if he could document it, and he said he could. They had followed up on every one of them. We learned that before Amsterdam 83, he had approximately 130 decisions over a 10-year period. When we found the man, we asked him what he was doing differently. He picked up a notebook he had gotten at the 1983 conference. "I've been doing this and this before I start preaching," he said, pointing to different sections in the notebook. "And when I preach, I do this and this and this." We asked him, "What about follow-up?" And he said, "This and this and this," just pointing to sections in his notebook. Sometimes we get so technical and it's all so basic. When the final selections were made, more than three-fourths of the nearly 8,200 invitees were from the Third World. Africa was most heavily represented, with 2,337 evangelists from 49 countries. In keeping with the principles of the Unreached People strategy articulated at Lausanne, effort was made to cover as many subgroups as possible within each country. In Nigeria, for example, at least one evangelist was selected from 136 of that nation's 137 major tribes. "We looked hard for an evangelist from the last tribe," a recruiter said, "but we just couldn't find one." Asia and Latin America each furnished approximately 1,500 envoys. The North American contingent numbered 1,361, and 32 countries of Eastern and Western Europe provided 1,009 delegates. The remainder of the contingent came mainly from the Middle East, Oceania, and the Caribbean. Graham was unable to obtain permission for 20 evangelists from the People's Republic of China to attend, but two PRC representatives, neither of whom were evangelists, were present. In the last accounting, evangelists streamed into Amsterdam from 173 countries, more, it appears, than had ever been represented at any gathering, religious or secular, in the history of the world. The selection committee had made a few mistakes. One man identified as a witch doctor was sent home as soon as his true colors were discovered. Several others used the conference to run a minor league scam, collecting names of Westerners, writing them later to request donations of Bibles and reference books for the libraries of their mission schools, then selling the books and pocketing the money for themselves. But some who showed up felt that they, not the selection committee, had been deceived. On registering, each delegate was tagged with a hospital-type wrist strap to be worn throughout the 10-day conference. Printed on it was an emergency telephone number, 42-51-51. At least two delegates left for home after noticing that each pair of numbers added up to 6, making it seem plausible that these straps were the dreaded mark of the beast, and that the conference itself was a major step in setting up the one-world church that would be the tool of the Antichrist. After due allowance for the inevitable tares among the wheat, It was an enthusiastic, dedicated, and extraordinarily variegated group of men and women who gathered for the conference. Some were crusade evangelists who moved from town to town holding revivals in the conventional and time-honored fashion. Others specialized in working with young people, prisoners, hospital patients, refugees, migrant worker camps, military personnel, lepers, or even, as in the case of two Dutch women, the prostitutes who ply their trade in Amsterdam's notorious red light district. Of 7,604 participants who responded to a survey, approximately one-third had some college or seminary training, but 601 had no formal training whatever. These are not high-powered TV evangelists, a conference staffer observed. These are guys walking 20 or 30 miles to share the gospel, going to Borneo and South Africa and Papua New Guinea. The overwhelming majority were in the favored age range of 25 to 45, with 31 the average age. Most of the older evangelists came from the Orient, where respect for age made it difficult to persuade prospective delegates that the available slots should go to younger men. More participants came from Baptist backgrounds than from any other single denomination, but in striking testimony to Billy Graham's commitment to fellowship with those outside the old evangelical pale, members of various Pentecostal groups outnumbered even the Baptists. In another adjustment to changing times, approximately 500 participants were women. Most evangelists from North America and Western Europe paid their own travel and lodging expenses. Third world preachers were encouraged to raise some portion of their expenses as a token of commitment, but BGEA underwrote most of their costs, as well as the substantial expense involved in planning the conference and in renting the sprawling RAI exhibition complex where it was held. When all the bills were tallied, the association had demonstrated its commitment to world evangelism by contributing approximately $21 million toward Amsterdam 86. Nearly all of it came from regulation-sized donations. No foundations or wealthy donors were approached. When a friend of the ministry offered a donation of $2 million a few days before the conference opened, Graham told him, "It's already paid for. Give your money to something else." In typical BGEA fashion, conference organizers paid great attention to doing things as economically as possible. Graham's hometown travel agency arranged bargain flights from all over the world. Staff members negotiated favorable rates with 85 Amsterdam hotels and saved great sums by housing 4,000 men in a makeshift dormitory set up in the Yarborough's Exhibition Center in Utrecht, 25 miles away. Special arrangements were made with Amsterdam's elaborate public transportation system so that anyone wearing an ICIE armband was allowed to ride anywhere the system's carriers went without buying a ticket. Equally typical, however, was a disregard for trouble or expense when a grand gesture was needed. A 200-person delegation from Argentina and Uruguay found itself stranded in Buenos Aires by a pilot strike. Because it was the height of the tourist season, staffers had to scour the world looking for a suitable aircraft to charter and send for the stranded evangelists. Eventually, they located a DC-8, described as the only airplane free in the entire world, and dispatched it from New York to Buenos Aires. The plight of the Argentine contingent became a dramatic focus for the conference during its opening sessions. Graham's announcement that a plane had been found met with thunderous applause. When a heavy fog made it impossible to land in Buenos Aires, thousands of fog-dispersing prayers flew upward. And when the weary Latins finally walked into the great hall where the plenary sessions were held, they were greeted as if they had been the last load to make the rapture. It was marvelous drama, and the Argentines became the darlings of the conference. It also cost $500,000, causing one of Billy Graham's staunchest admirers to volunteer that one cannot help wondering if the money might not have been better spent. Some participants overcame even greater obstacles than the Argentines. A Sri Lankan evangelist spent 40 hours dodging gunfire and bombs and picking his way around landmines as he crossed 60 miles of civil war zone on his way to the airport in Colombo. Others bore the scars of persecution inflicted by people hostile to them and the gospel they preached. Still others spoke matter-of-factly of the perils they faced in trying to carry out the Great Commission. "We cannot go easily into the Muslim areas to preach and spread the gospel," a Lebanese evangelist explained. "Why not?" "Because they will kill us." On several occasions, Billy Graham personally greeted delegations as they arrived at the RAI Center by bus. At one such encounter, a knot of diminutive Indian evangelists was obviously stunned to find the tall, tanned evangelist, who seemed to them more a legend than a flesh-and-blood person, suddenly plunging into their midst, pumping their hands, and thanking them for coming. They were not alone in being moved. A few days later, Graham told a press conference that when he met men who had gone to prison and been beaten and reviled for trying to do what he had been able to do with great reward and honor, "I felt like a worm." Even in cosmopolitan, polyglot Amsterdam, the sheer variety of the visitors drew attention. Dutch television carried stories of African men who began digging latrines shortly after arriving in Yarboroughs, and of blacks astonished to see white stewards bringing breakfast to their bedsides, not realizing such a thing could occur anywhere in the world. The participants themselves were staggered at the experience of seeing so many Christians from so many other parts of the world. They suddenly realized, Werner Berkland remarked, that we are all one in Christ. We have the same Savior, the same gospel, the same call. One man, an African bishop, accustomed to and expecting more plush accommodations, decided to stay on at Yarboroughs a day or two before arranging for something a bit less Spartan. After imbibing the rich spirit of the multicultural fellowship for a short time, however, he chose not to leave, declaring grandly that this place is like heaven. The conference began with Olympic-style pageantry as six runners, symbolizing the six continents, carried torches from the far reaches of the great Europol, and together lit a central flame that would burn throughout the conference, symbolizing the light of the world that participants were preparing to reveal more brightly. Then, as Cliff Barrows read the names of the 173 countries represented in that assembly, and a brace of trumpets filled the air with the stirring strains of onward Christian soldiers, stewards bearing the flags of those countries crisscrossed the vast auditorium, itself already festooned with maroon and gray banners bearing the legend, "Do the work of an evangelist," in dozens of different languages. Iraqi and Iranian Christians, both representing tiny minority populations, stood alongside each other, their eyes glistening with tears, as did Jewish and Arab Christians from Palestine and evangelists from both South and North Korea. A white South African embraced his black countryman and brother in Christ. Though it is unlikely anyone missed the symbolism, a narrator reminded the diverse assembly that we are not strangers or enemies, but fellow citizens of a heavenly kingdom. As they joined together to sing, "Crown him with many crowns," some holding hands, many shedding tears of joy, almost all were caught up in a transcendent unity of spirit. Though Graham has been remarkable in his ability to stimulate response around the world by preaching essentially the same sermon, ICIE organizers did not believe a one-size-fits-all approach would be effective for the average native evangelist. "We cannot adapt to the culture," program director John Court said, "to the extent that we change the message, but we need to be sensitive to it, so that we will not seem to be demanding an American, Western, high-tech kind of approach. For example, only two African countries have a literacy rate as high as 65%. Distributing Bibles may not be the key factor in such a country. We can't tell people to write to Billy Graham, Minneapolis, Minnesota. That's all the address you need. They live in an entirely different world, and we have to be sensitive to that. I've been part of Billy's big American crusades with the highly polished formats. I've helped shape that. But that is not what we are doing here. I've never served out in the bush. But I've been there, and I know what goes on in that setting. I've seen what they are doing, and I've tried to listen to what they are saying as we set up this program." During the conference, Billy Graham and his stalwart band of associates from around the world sounded the great themes of the gospel message, each elaborating on one of the Amsterdam affirmations, a set of 15 brief principal statements agreed upon by participants at the 1983 conference. Graham himself gave 4 plenary addresses. Though not at his own insistence, prior to the conference he repeatedly, and apparently quite sincerely, argued for a smaller role. "I raise the money rather than do the work," he said. "It has not taken much of my personal time. I have a great staff, and I was able to delegate responsibility and leave them alone almost from the beginning." Because he had not done the work, he seemed to feel he had not earned the right to take a major role. "We polled people who are coming to this conference," Walter Smith said, "to see what they wanted to hear. 90% of them want to hear from Billy Graham, to learn how he does it. And we've had the hardest time getting the poor man to speak. He keeps saying, 'Look, I don't want to dominate this. This is not a Billy Graham show.' But we've had to say to him, 'Billy, these evangelists look to you. They want to hear you. They will listen to others, but nobody is going to take your place in this conference.' It's like pulling teeth to get him to speak more than once." John Quartz told a similar story. "You see the dynamic preacher out front," he observed. "I see the guy sitting in his hotel room in his baseball cap and dungarees asking, 'What am I supposed to say to these people? How am I supposed to answer their questions?'" As powerful a presence as he inevitably was, Graham was far from being the whole show. Argentine Baptist leader Samuel Liebert held forthably with a discourse on the evangelist's authority, the word and the spirit. And evangelist professor Ravi Zacharias spoke eloquently of the lostness of man. Billy Kim thrilled the assembly with an electrifying, if often quite funny, explication of the conditions required to bring about the revival we need. Godfrey Osemensah spoke on the Great Commission. Moody Bible Institute President George Sweeting described the evangelist's passion for the lost. Nielsen Fanini stressed the importance of the evangelist's commitment to the church, and Franklin Graham spoke movingly about the evangelist's ministry among situations of human need. Layered in with these exhortations to action were sermon after sermon on the importance of the character of evangelists. Stephen Olford issued a thundering summons to the personal life of holiness, and in a stunning display of a genetic gift for capturing the attention of a great assembly, Graham's daughter, Ann Lotz, delivered a riveting address on the evangelist's faithfulness, driving her points home with the same two-pistol hand gesture and hammering cadence her father had used so effectively for 40 years. Each plenary address was set in the context of a worship service. In addition to prayers and congregational singing, most sessions featured Up With Jesus music from the Continental Brass and Singers, a talented group of young people in Miami Vice clothes who served as the house band, or from one of more than 20 other multinational groups and soloists, including a 15-member choir from the Moscow Baptist Church. At least once each day, a dramatic troupe known as the Lamb's Players, and headed by Walter Smith's son, Bob, presented brief playlets closely geared to the theme of that session. One skit, on the pitfalls that lie on the path of charismatic leaders, drew knowing laughter and self-conscious winces as it presaged the scandals that would explode within the world of television evangelism a scant few months later. The plenary sessions gave the little guys a chance to see the big guys, and for the most part, the big guys showed why they were at the top of their profession. But much of the most important work of the conference, the detailed transmission of pragmatic instruction, went on in more than 160 seminars and workshops. Every participant was obliged to attend 5 seminars, one each on preparation for an evangelistic event, preparation and delivery of an evangelistic message, giving the evangelistic invitation, counselor training, and follow-up methods. While the plenary sessions were delivered in English and translated simultaneously into 15 languages, any one of which could be tuned in on the headphones attached to wireless receivers available to all participants. The seminars were broken into 19 language and regional groups to enable materials developed by master teachers to be adapted to a wide range of situations. The workshops were far more varied in content, and more limited as to the number of languages in which a given topic was discussed. But few participants had difficulty finding topics of interest among the 24 or so dealt with each day, ranging from working with pre-literates to getting on secular television and radio talk shows, and including a host of sessions on such themes as open-air preaching, writing for publication, working with prisoners and the disabled, preaching to Muslims, management techniques for an evangelistic ministry, and training other evangelists. Women evangelists and wives of male participants were free to attend any session they wished, but a limited women's program was also available. The most memorable session on that agenda was led jointly by Cliff and Billy Barrow's daughter, Bonnie Barrow Thomas, and by Ruth Graham, who talked frankly and engagingly about the high and low points of the life of an evangelist wife, drawing warm appreciation for such frank and commonsensical observations as, "I find Christian parents without problem children can be stuffy. If you have a prodigal, you will love all prodigals." John Courts and other program organizers often pointed out that they were following a technical education model in the seminars and workshops, dealing with concrete technique far more than abstract theory. To help participants implement their new knowledge more readily, 7,000 evangelists from third world countries received canvas knapsacks filled with books, sermon outlines, cassette recordings of sermons by Graham and others, and to play them in villages and homes where electricity was non-existent and batteries unobtainable, a hand-cranked tape player. As a logical extension of that pragmatic approach, the next-to-last afternoon of the conference was designated a day of witness, on which participants tried to put into action what they had learned in face-to-face confrontation with the unsaved. "It's a little phony," Courts admitted, "because let's face it, they don't speak Dutch. But it's an attempt to give them an experience of going out into the street and seeing what it means to use what they have learned in a real situation." The Netherlands had surely never experienced such a concentrated display of concern for its lost condition. After a brief demonstration to let them know what kind of responses they might expect, evangelists clambered onto 120 chartered buses that dispatched them to 68 locations in 49 Dutch cities and villages. Predictably, many encounters misfired, as when an American evangelist who approached a group of women engaged in animated conversation soon found himself the target of the evangelistic efforts of the lesbian collective to get the U.S. out of Nicaragua. A small but imaginative band of Latin American messengers met with no greater success when they essayed to bring Christ to nude bathers on a beach at Scheveningen. Billy Graham himself, ostensibly camouflaged in dark glasses, windbreaker, and baseball cap, spent time in Amsterdam's sprawling Vondel Park. When he was able to avoid the efforts of unwary ICIE delegates to convert him, he spoke with several small groups, one of which asked him to leave them alone, and another, whose members seemed more interested in what they were smoking than in what he was saying. Some evangelists met negative, even abusive reactions, but most seemed encouraged by the experience. When results were tallied at the end of the day, they were told that the gospel had been communicated to more than 40,000 people on that single afternoon, and that more than 300 firm commitments were known to have been made, the first fruits of the great harvest expected from Amsterdam 86. In many respects, Amsterdam 86 bore little resemblance to the first major Graham-sponsored conference at Berlin. But the two did share at least one notable feature. Carl McIntyre came to both, uninvited and unwelcome. Well past 80, but still capable of red-eyed fury, McIntyre set up a booth in the lobby of a large hotel adjacent to the RAI Center and offered free Billy Graham books to the many evangelists quartered there, and to any others who dropped in on their way to a nearby train station. The books were free, and they were about Billy Graham. They were also, of course, highly critical of the evangelist whom McIntyre had long characterized as the greatest disappointment in the Christian church. With fellow Graham basher Edgar C. Bundy nodding agreement at his side, McIntyre reported that in the week he had been at his post, he had talked to dozens and dozens of evangelists who were astonished at what I told them. He fumed that Graham had allowed a Russian chorus to sing, and identified a Russian evangelist at the conference as a hardcore KGB strongman who has broken necks and killed people. He pointed to the large numbers of Pentecostals and charismatics at the conference as evidence that Graham's lack of concern for pure doctrine was leading to a one-world church, just as predicted in the book of Revelation. And though he grudgingly conceded that Graham does know how to raise money and put on a conference, he made it clear he thought the $21 million BGA had spent on the conference was a damnable bit of stewardship. They spent $2 million just on food and hell. After a moving communion service that, despite the use of a wine substitute, tasting remarkably like strawberry Kool-Aid, inevitably summoned images of a messianic banquet, the conference ended on Sunday evening, July 20. Billy Graham preached on the second coming, and 10,000 evangelical Christians from the ends of the earth prepared to depart for their homelands. Fully aware that most of them would never meet again, unless and until that longed-for advent actually came to pass. As a final galvanizing act, Graham read the 15 Amsterdam affirmations, and the largest gathering of evangelists ever to assemble in one place fairly shouted, "We affirm," in response to each. Then six torchbearers lit their lamps from the flame that had burned throughout the conference and headed back toward the world's six continents. As the bearers of 173 flags followed in train, Graham solemnly intoned, "You are witnesses to that light. Go preach the good news to your nations. You are his messengers. The glory of the Lord is upon you, for the Lord has turned our darkness into light, that we may proclaim the salvation of our God to all the nations. Do the work of an evangelist." Had Billy Graham and BGEA done nothing further than send 12,000 fully charged and freshly prepared evangelists back to their homelands, the results of the Amsterdam conferences would probably have a significant impact on hundreds of thousands of individual lives before the wheels set in motion there finally rolled to a stop. But 3.5 years later, the model developed for these gatherings was being emulated in dozens of smaller gatherings throughout the world. In 1988, 26 mini Amsterdams were held in Latin America alone, culminating in a Los Angeles gathering that drew 6,000 evangelists working with Latins in both North and South America. Other meetings drew between 2,000 and 3,000 participants. And at the beginning of 1990, John Kortz reported that BGEA had supported and helped organize 88 such conferences, with an aggregate attendance of more than 46,000 evangelists from 97 countries. There were no plans to discontinue the program. Chapter 33, The Constituted Means. Dramatic and path-breaking as they were, Graham's visits to the Soviet bloc nations and the Amsterdam conferences did not long divert him from the well-worn crusade trail. During the early 1980s, he held crusades in Canada, Japan, Mexico, Baltimore, Boston, Boise, San Jose, Houston, Spokane, Chapel Hill, Orlando, Fort Lauderdale, Tacoma, Sacramento, Anchorage, Oklahoma City, Hartford, and Anaheim. In 1984 to 1985, he conducted a highly successful two-stage Mission England that included 7 full-scale campaigns in major cities other than London and live-link satellite video meetings in 50 additional cities. In 1986, he followed up the Washington, D.C. crusade with a meeting in Tallahassee, and with Mission France, an effective effort that originated in Paris in the midst of terrorist bomb scares and sent the gospel flying by satellite to 31 cities throughout that nation. In 1987, he opened the season in Columbia, South Carolina, in the same stadium where Henry Luce had first heard him 37 years earlier, then checked off all the remaining parts of the country in which he had never held crusades in a 5-state peaks-to-plains barnstorming tour that wound up in Denver's Mile High Stadium. He closed that year with an encouraging campaign in Helsinki. Then, as the decade ended, the premier evangelist of the second half of the 20th century, consciously sought to associate himself with his counterpart from the first half of the 19th by beginning a series of crusades that would take him to the same cities in upstate New York, where Charles Grandison Finney had stamped his indelible mark on American revivalism. With 40 years of experience in the vault, Graham's crusade team unquestionably had its act together, so that when an invitation to hold a crusade was received, pondered, and accepted, it could roll into a city and roll out a crusade along well-established lines, pursuing what Charles Finney called the right use of the constituted means. Most of the time, its accomplishments were quite predictable, within a modest range of variance, although the results were often not exactly what the sponsoring churches expected or what the Graham team implied. And the process was not quite the automatic, self-contained, flawless operation it may have appeared to be from the outside. Still, a Billy Graham Greater Anywhere crusade, however much it may have depended on the Spirit of God for its success, was a remarkable exercise in rational organization and action. Team members did not want to appear as manipulators of ostensibly spiritual phenomena and were invariably careful not to relegate deity to the sidelines. But Sterling Houston, director of North American Crusades, freely acknowledged that, yes, we have a plan. We know one way, and it will work for local congregations if they will follow it. We try to be flexible and adapt the plan to a local situation, but when they invite Mr. Graham to come, this is the only plan we know that really works. We want it contextualized, but the skeleton, the principles, the goals don't change. The degree to which the plan was followed varied somewhat with the personality of the particular crusade director assigned to a given campaign. But David Bruce, a Denver pastor who worked with the follow-up program on numerous crusades, noted that there is a sense in which because you have a short timeline, you almost have to come in and say, "Look, we've done this for 40 years. This is the game plan. Get on board with us." This approach often worked better at home than abroad. In the 1986 Mission France, resistance to what French churchmen dubbed an entreprise parachutée, a complete system dropped from an American gospel transport plane, made it necessary to give more control to local leaders. The resulting blend of local custom and imported practice was both successful and amusing. In Strasbourg, the lovely old Alsatian city near France's northeastern border with Germany, satellite service organizers saw nothing incongruous in having concessionaires sell beer and sausage or in allowing worshippers to smoke during the services. And the Graham people apparently felt no need to complain about these breaches of American pietistic practice. As long as the soccer stadium scoreboard proclaimed that, "Je vous dis, je suis le chemin, la vérité et la vie," and the book tables had plenty of copies of Le Pays Avenu and Un Monde aux Flammes. But some American evangelicals felt the Graham method was too inflexible. One pastor who had worked in several Graham crusades over the years charged the team with putting on a dog and pony show, with little evidence of struggle or growth or ambiguity. The concern for people is great, no question about that. But there are some going through the motions. It would seem that there is such a dramatic difference between Spokane, Boise, Houston, and Boston, that there's got to be some reflection of that, and that a great organization like BGEA ought not to be just transplanting the same thing in every community. Instead, he felt the team and the plan had developed a kind of rigidity that does not listen. Most of the crusade directors have done this so often that they are weary of it. John Massagno, pastor of Houston's 21,000-member First Baptist Church, agreed that greater flexibility was needed, but conceded that when you have a 30-year track record of the most successful evangelism in the world, why should they let local committees come in and get them to change their plans? Graham's remarkable record did indeed enable him to overcome obstacles that would surely thwart a lesser figure. Seldom was this more clearly in evidence than in Mission France. To help the evangelist gain permission to use the sparkling new 15,000-seat Palais Omnisport de Paris-Bercy, U.S. Ambassador Joe M. Rogers, a former Tennessee contractor who had attended Graham Crusades in both Knoxville and Nashville, successfully interceded with Paris Mayor Jacques Chirac. Rogers, it happens, was not acting entirely on his own. With some bemusement, he observed that 2 years into his term as his country's ambassador to France, President Reagan had given him only two assignments, one of which was to help Billy Graham get the use of Bercy. The other was to arrange a meeting between Graham and President François Mitterrand. Similar cooperation obtained at other levels. When terrorists initiate a frightening series of bombings in public places a few days before the crusade opened, the city responded by providing Graham and his team with bulletproof automobiles and deploying 2,500 heavily armed policemen and soldiers to stand guard at the arena and search everyone who entered each night of the crusade. Security was seldom the obvious problem that it was during the Paris campaign, but great care was always taken both to protect Graham and his team from injury or harassment, and to preclude or short-circuit any attempts to disrupt the services. In most cities, the team worked closely with local police, or in some places, national police, military, and intelligence forces for months before a crusade to map out detailed security and crowd control plans. When circumstances seemed to justify it, the association hired former Secret Servicemen to oversee security operations. "People try to get to him," Tex Reardon said simply. "You don't always know for what purpose. We try to protect him from strangers walking off the street." The team's own security personnel downplayed physical threats to avoid setting up challenges for addled publicity seekers, and also to protect Graham from anxiety. For the most part, their efforts were limited to greater attentiveness to possible problems. "If someone comes in with a package," Reardon explained, "we don't deliberately search it or anything, but we note it. We log where it is." In addition, they altered a long-standing practice of storing programs and counseling materials under the speaker's platform. If you were going to do anything, what better place than a cardboard box under a platform? So we eliminate boxes. We also have guards watching the facilities all night. Graham knew of such measures, but if they bothered him, he managed not to show it. He told Ruth and his colleagues not to pay ransom if he were ever kidnapped, and he appeared to believe in good Presbyterian fashion that nothing would happen to him unless God willed it. Ruth shared his view, contending that nothing can touch a child of God without his permission. Still, Graham and his staff took precautions against the twisted fantasies and the misplaced hatreds demented souls sometimes direct toward public figures. According to T.W. Wilson, the evangelist received more threats of violence during the mid-1980s than during the 30 years prior to that. Pulling out a 4-inch folder filled with vile imprecations that documented his point, he said, "We turn all threats over to the FBI, and they look into it. Some of the language is so filthy and the hatred so bitter, you wouldn't believe it. One warned, 'I'm going to get you. I'm going to cut your wife's body in small pieces, feed her innards to wild animals, and bury the rest in a shallow grave. I have never been arrested and have no police record.'" It was signed with a swastika. Because the letter bore a California postmark and had been addressed to a BGEA post office box, it seemed like the writer was on the ministry's mailing list. The FBI narrowed the field to 4,000 neo-Nazis in the San Diego area, cut that number to a dozen most likely candidates, and assigned agents to stake out each one of them. When the would-be assailant, a young woman, sent the fifth such letter, agents arrested her, went to her home, and found the typewriter in which she had punched out her malevolent missives, and confronted her shocked parents with what their daughter had been doing. Apparently feeling little real danger existed, Graham decided not to press charges. "If they really want you," Wilson conceded, "they can usually get you. But we take all the threats seriously. We have more trouble with religious nuts than anything else." One part of the crusade plan that seldom worked perfectly, even after 40 years, was the effort to increase black participation in crusade preparations and black attendance at services. Team members admit that despite their efforts to integrate the crusades, blacks still regarded them as predominantly a white enterprise and did not usually participate as fully as had been hoped. Charges that BGEA was not sensitive to black issues and sensibilities stung Graham, and he directed his associates to make every conceivable effort to involve blacks in the 1986 Greater Washington Crusade. John Akers acknowledged that, "We made our best shot with regard to blacks in Washington. We have tended to do what whites tend to do, make plans and invite blacks to join in. This time we made a deliberate effort to involve black churches and black leadership from the beginning. Every committee had a black co-chair. But we did not do this in Tallahassee a few months later. Ralph Bell agreed that the association really went out of its way in Washington. If that same effort were made in other crusades, I think it would be much better. But we have not made as much effort since then. We forget really quickly. I think it is in Billy's mind, but I don't think it is in the minds of the guys who carry it out to really involve themselves in the black community. At times in a team meeting, we have talked about developing a strategy to reach black America. We've said we're going to talk about it and cry over it and pray about it and get ideas and call in resource people and explore opportunities and so forth. It's a good idea, but it never happens. It's a matter of commitment. If it were a matter of technology, they would explore the avenues, figure out how to do it, and go ahead and do it. But I don't think that, apart from Billy himself, that we have been committed to that goal with respect to the black community. Some blacks have noted that the decorous style of Graham's Crusades lacked the spirit and demonstrative character of the worship services to which they are accustomed. Some white supporters felt the same way. John Bassanio, whose church in Houston is a model of Baptist respectability, ventured that Cliff and the team have overreacted a little bit too much over the years to criticism. They're trying a little too hard not to be specifically emotional in the services. I'm hearing people say they are surprised that the services seem kind of structured and flat. They're not experiencing the kind of life and excitement that they anticipate. We shouldn't program the joy of the Lord and natural excitement out of the services. Barrow's intention was not simply to be innocuous, but to try to create a service that would be familiar and reassuring to people who do not go to church regularly. While it is true that the music in many evangelical churches is far livelier than that in Graham's Crusades, he felt that the limits are set not by what Christians would enjoy, but by what non-Christians will find comfortable and reassuring. For that reason, Crusade hymns were usually those likely to be recognized by non-regular attenders. Bless the Lord, O my soul. Amazing grace, and when we all get to heaven. This ruled out most newer songs and courses. Barrows also avoided choosing hymns that contained such words or phrases as, I worship, I adore, or I praise your name, which might embarrass outsiders or make them feel they don't belong. These sentiments were left to the choir or soloist, who presumably could sing them with a clearer conscience. Barrows was not adamant in resisting change, and adjusted to some more recent developments in Christian music. But organist John Ennis acknowledged that Cliff keeps a pretty tight rein. He talks to the special artists carefully. But his more nervous moments are likely to come with the people who give testimony than with the singers, because you don't know how long they're going to take, or really, what they're going to say when they get up there. Crusade guests did generate a bit of anxiety for the platform team, particularly when they were appearing for the first time. Some like Grammy-winning vocalist Sandy Patty and Larnell Harris, country music performer George Hamilton IV, and British singer Cliff Richard were known and dependable entities. Johnny Cash, another regular, caused little worry about his performance. But his occasional relapse into drug use caused some problems for Graham, who doggedly stuck by his longtime friend and put him back on the platform, penitent and presumably forgiven, as soon as he was physically and emotionally able to get there. In addition to musicians, Crusades typically featured several Christians from the sports world, such as former Dallas Cowboy coach Tom Landry, former baseball standout Pat Kelly, who was director of Christian fan outreach, and husband of Howard Jones' daughter, Phyllis, and various local sports figures who affirmed that their greatest accomplishment in life came when they became a member of the greatest team under Coach Jesus, who will never cut them from the squad. Former NBA basketball star Pete Maravich had just begun to give testimony at Graham's Crusades a few months before he died of a heart attack in 1987. And professional wrestler Hulk Hogan may have been auditioning for a spot in evangelicalism's main event when he made a point of visiting Graham during the Denver Crusade, talking with the evangelist about his own roots in the Baptist Church, his personal faith in God, and the privilege of leading his father to Christ shortly before his death. Guest artists, celebrity testifiers, announcement makers, and prayer givers were all urged to keep the remarks short and succinct to make sure they leave plenty of time for Mr. Graham. Though he was pleased to use celebrities to draw crowds and to demonstrate that Christianity need not be a drab and lifeless affair, Graham unquestionably felt that the main event of his meetings was the sermon itself, and he expected Cliff Barrows to see to it that people didn't have to wait too long to hear him, and that he had plenty of time to say what he wanted to say. When a singer threw in a gratuitous testimony, or a testimony giver took an extra 2 minutes to reveal an unexpected defeat or triumph in the struggle with Satan, Graham began to cast impatient glances at Cliff and to nibble anxiously at his fingernails. The team's largely successful efforts to knock off rough edges, polish away the bumps, and remove any burrs that might make a visitor uncomfortable produced a service that, for whatever it may have lacked in the thrills, produced at revivals featuring dramatic healings, outbursts of tongue-speaking, and rows of ecstatic believers strewn around the pulpit after having been slain in the spirit, nevertheless provided an important and impressive kind of ritual reassurance and reaffirmation. In America, at least, most people who attended the Crusades either belonged to or grew up in churches where such middle-of-the-road styles and sentiments were the norm. For them, a Billy Graham Crusade was like a gigantic homecoming reunion, an upbeat, friendly, non-threatening festival that assured them that the old verities are still to be believed, the old songs and prayers still sung and prayed, the old threats and dangers still out there huffing and puffing, but still equally easy to keep at bay if one will only believe. Crucial to the success of this ritual, and to Billy Graham's remarkable longevity as a crusader, was his ability to enlist representatives of the mass media as key soldiers in his campaigns. On occasion, of course, the press was anything but friendly toward him. But anyone who spends several days in the BGEA headquarters browsing through the oversized scrapbooks that fill an entire room cannot help but be impressed with the overwhelmingly positive treatment the media lavished upon him for four decades. That response was neither unsought nor uncultivated. Larry Ross, a Walter Bennett Communications employee assigned almost exclusively to the Graham organization, which was the agency's only major continuing account, speculated that the favorable treatment Graham typically received from reporters is an example of the benefits of following the Golden Rule. The press generally treated him well because of how well he treats the press. He is so gracious even when he is dealing with reporters who have written stories that are not in his best interest. He gives them more time than they request or expect. Many times I've seen him bless those who curse him. I think the Lord has honored that. Even those who don't agree with his message respect the man and his transparent goodness. Veteran AP religion writer George Cornell agreed that Graham seemed able to parry even the most pointed thrusts from hostile reporters. He has the plain, ingenuous directness of a genuinely free human being. A further reason Graham was able to maintain good relations with the press was his habit of paying them public praise during his crusade services. In 1950, he asked his Boston audiences to write to the editors or publishers of the local newspapers to thank them for the marvelous coverage the crusade had received. 40 years later, he was still making the same request, sometimes even singling out one or two reporters, typically the key religion writers from the Crusade City's major papers, for special praise. The Bennett Agency counted on the local press to provide an abundance of free publicity for Graham's crusades, and sometimes kept careful score of the results. After the 1984 phase of Mission England, for example, Gavin Reed reported that the national press had published 157 items and 11 editorials, covering nearly 3,000 column inches. The regional press, and we were deliberately working to capitalize on regional awareness, published 1,262 items plus 18 editorials, taking up no less than 37,116 column inches. Radio time amounted to nearly 8.5 hours, and television time amounted to 5 hours, 7 minutes. Reed and his assistants had made these tallies at the specific request of the Graham organization. Predictably, however, the agency did not rely solely on cooperative journalists. Every crusade involved a saturation advertising campaign, and though Graham sometimes professed to wish he never had to see his name on another billboard or banner, even his closest friends and staunchest backers admit that he handled whatever embarrassment he felt with considerable equanimity. Bob Evans recalled that shortly before the 1986 crusade, when he came to Paris, he said, "Get some more pictures up. I don't see my picture up enough." He got special permission to put posters in the metro stations. He felt like he needed more publicity. And Fred Dienert, who was personally responsible for puffing Graham for 40 years, said in unambiguous admiration, "Bill understands the value of publicity. At night, when he can't sleep, God evidently gives him thoughts about the ministry, about promotion, about what to do here and there. It's uncanny, and they work out well. And it's because the Lord's got his hand on him. It's not us. We do the newspapers, we do the billboards, we buy the spots and everything else. I believe all that helps, but I think the real answer is God."